Welcome to today's reading of the Counts Blessed Nonpareil. I'm John McPartlin. I'll be your reader for today. This is for Monday, March 11th, 2024. Here's our first story. Protecting Trout Stream is Tricky. This is by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. There were two mass trout killings within a year at McLeod Run, the cold water stream in the heart of Cedar Rapids that is regularly stocked with fish by the state. While that was the first time that trout kills have been reported so close in time at the stream, they are grudgingly accepted reality of maintaining a sensitive fish population in Iowa's second largest city. All you need is one bad slug of water going through and the fish can't handle it, said Paul Sleeper, a fisheries management biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Trout are especially sensitive to water temperature and contamination, and in Cedar Rapids, the threats are numerous. The 2.5 miles of McLeod shadows Interstate Highway 3380 and is in close proximity to businesses, industry, and houses with ever-present pesticides, toxic fluids, and warm water runoff from concrete. There are about 30 outlets into the stream that drain storm water from the area. Somebody could dump something a mile up in a residential area and it could get down a storm sewer, Sleeper said, and it could be very difficult for us to tell where it came from or even what it was. But there is another threat that has proved most deadly in recent years, the city's drinking water. Municipal water is commonly treated with chlorine to kill bacteria. The concentration of the chemical is small enough to be safe for humans, but it is high enough to readily kill trout by damaging their gills. There is no concentration that ensures the safety of drinking water and trout, Sleeper said. The most recent large release of drinking water to the stream in January might have killed off all of its trout in the affected segment, which was nearly all of the stream, he said. State conservation officials have worked for decades to maintain and restore the dozens of trout streams in picturesque northeast Iowa. They have historically been harmed by erosion and pollution from agriculture. The DNR stocks the streams with hundreds of thousands of trout each year, and the streams increasingly have fish populations that are reproducing naturally. That is unlikely to happen at McLeod Run, Sleeper said, so the department will continue to regularly stock it to encourage people to fish for trout. It is the southernmost such stream available in Iowa and is easily accessible. Sleeper said it might inspire anglers to travel to the mountainous hills, exposed bedrock, and clear streams farther away. He said McLeod also serves as an outdoor learning classroom for students at local schools and colleges. The DNR stocks it each year with thousands of trout, ranging in size from fingerlings to adults, McLeod says. McLeod is a catch-and-release stream. McLeod is posed for increased restocking this year after a water line broke in a vacant commercial building next to the stream and released an estimated 450,000 gallons of water in late January. The DNR believes water in a fire suppression line in the building froze and then leaked when it later thawed, said Brenda Stryker, an environmental specialist for the department who investigated the incident. The building is about 250 feet from the stream. Sleeper found 336 dead trout after the incident, but said many more likely perished because of the chlorine. The upstream location of the water leak caused it to affect a longer stretch of McLeod than past incidents, and Sleeper did not see any live trout. It is very challenging to locate this type of leak and mitigate it in a timely manner, said Kelly Albert, a spokesperson for the Cedar Rapids Utility Department. The city is well aware of the threat its water poses to the stream and has procedures to dechlorinate it during planned and emergency releases, she said. The city has been fined twice in the past 6 years for fish kills the water has caused in McLeod. Despite that, the city has done an excellent job trying to protect the stream, Sleeper said. Not long before the most recent incident, the city agreed to pay about $24,000 for a March 2023 fish kill that resulted from a water main break. City workers sought to limit the impact of the leak on the stream by adding dechlorination tablets to the water, but it still killed about 1,400 trout, according to a DNR order. In 2017, a water valve broke during construction work and leaked up to half million gallons of water. That killed 1,300 trout, and the city paid about $23,000, according to another DNR order. In 2016, a contaminant killed several hundred trout, but the department was unable to determine the cause. There are likely other smaller fish kills that go unnoticed. It just depends whether somebody actually reports that, Sleeper said. Some of it can be just a few fish here and there, and they quickly get cleaned up by predators. Albert, the city spokesperson, said it isn't possible to make Cedar Rapids drinking water safe for both humans and trout, and it is infeasible to divert stormwater runoff away from the stream. We're constantly improving our practices, systems, and approach to control these types of events, she said, of water leaks. Our next story is trio hailed by Wings of Hope during 30th anniversary gala. Wings of Hope Cancer Support Center presented awards to a trio of people who have made a difference over the organization's 30-year history. Wings of Hope Cancer Support Center kicked off its 30th anniversary year, February 10th, at its 2024 Winter Gala, according to the news release. The event was held at the Mid-American Center, and attendees were encouraged to wear red and pearls to celebrate the milestone. In addition to the evening's activities, three people were honored with awards. Local auctioneer Gail Hunter was presented with the 2024 Larry Hill Memorial Award, which honors individuals who share their gifts and talents to benefit cancer patients and their families in the metro and throughout Southwest Iowa. Hunter is a third-generation auctioneer, has been involved in hundreds of successful real estate and benefit auctions. He has been donating his services to Wings of Hope Gala for more than a decade, helping the organization raise thousands of dollars via its oral and program auctions. Larry Hill, an autist and cancer survivor, was the member of the original board of directors. Patty Hickenbotham, president of the Wings of Hope Cancer Support Center board of directors, was recognized for her vision and dedication to the organization throughout its three decades of service. Hickenbotham is the founder of Wings of Hope, which she started in October of 1987 as a monthly cancer support group where people met to discuss issues about living with cancer. Wings of Hope received its nonprofit status in September 1994. Caroline Ettinger, executive director of Wings of Hope, was presented with the inaugural Carolyn Ettinger Beacon of Hope Award. Going forward, it will honor an individual, organization, or business that serves as a beacon of hope for cancer patients in the metro and throughout Southwest Iowa. A public nomination process for next year's award will begin in April, and it will be presented at the 2025 Winter Gala. Nominees must exhibit compassion, receptiveness, and super listening skills for those on the cancer journey. For more information about programs and services, visit wingsofhope.org. Our next story is by Mark Moran, Iowa News Service. Daily Iowan saves two rural newspapers from extinction. The University of Iowa's Daily Newspaper has purchased two small-town papers as part of an attempt to keep local news alive in rural Iowa, while at the same time giving university journalism students more real-world experience. Experts who study the practice of journalism said the acquisition might be the first of its kind. The university's student-run newspaper, The Daily Iowan, bills itself as an independent student paper with an audience of about 50,000, run by 100 student employees. It just bought Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun and the Solon Economist. Richard Watts, director of the Center for Community News at the University of Vermont, which analyzes the impact of student-run journalism operations. He said it could be a solution to shore up local news deserts. "Across the country, we're losing 2 newspapers a week," he said, "and it's a tremendous crisis. Some 80 million Americans have no source of local news." Watts argued well-run student newspapers, while owned by universities, adhere to the same rigorous editorial and ethical standards as standalone journalism operations, and contended investing in local papers that would otherwise fail is an important place for colleges and universities to invest, and it could serve as a model in other places facing a loss of local news reporting. Watts said that the universities have the staff, space, and resources to keep local papers and information outlets alive in news deserts, not just in Iowa, but across the country. "Many universities and colleges are located in rural areas," Watts said. "There are 1,316 college campuses that are located in a news desert or adjacent to a news desert. So that's 1,300 college campuses with some institutional strength that could come in and address this." The Solon and Mount Vernon Lisbon newspapers, both within a half hour of the University of Iowa's campus, have historically covered local news, which the publisher says will now be able to continue. Terms of the deal were not disclosed, but the money came out of the Daily Iowan operating budget. U.S. forces go to embassy. Presence meant to beef up security allow non-essentials to leave. This is by Evans Sanan, Associated Press. The U.S. military said Sunday that it had flown in forces to beef up security at the U.S. Embassy in Haiti and allow non-essential personnel to leave. The aircraft flew to the embassy compound, the U.S. Southern Command said, meaning that its effort involved helicopters. It was careful to point out that no Haitians were on board the military aircraft. That seemed aimed at quashing any speculation that senior government officials might be leaving as the gang attacks in Haiti worsened. The neighborhood around the embassy in the capital, Port-au-Prince, is largely controlled by gangs. This airlift of personnel into and out of the embassy is consistent with our standard practice for embassy security augmentations worldwide, and no Haitians were on board the military aircraft, according to the Southcom statement. In many cases, non-essential personnel can include the families of diplomats, but the embassy had already ordered departure for non-essential staff and all family members in July. The personnel ferried out of the embassy may have simply been rotating out to be refreshed by new staff. The statement Sunday said that the United States remains focused on aiding Haitian police and arranging some kind of UN-authorized security detail deployment, but those efforts have been unsuccessful so far. Haiti's embattled Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, traveled recently to Kenya to push for the UN-backed deployment of a police force from the East African country to fight the gangs. But a Kenyan court ruled in January that such a deployment would be unconstitutional. Henry, who is facing calls to resign or to form a transitional council, remains unable to return home. He arrived in Puerto Rico on Tuesday after he was unable to land in the Dominican Republic, which borders Haiti. On Saturday, the office of Dominican President Luis Abinader issued a statement saying, "Henry is not welcome in the Dominican Republic for safety reasons." The Dominican Republic, which shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti, has closed its land borders. Given the current situation, the presence of the Haitian Prime Minister in the Dominican Republic is not considered appropriate, according to the statement, adding that this decision reflects the firm position of the Dominican Republic to safeguard its national security and stability. The statement described the security situation in Haiti as totally unsustainable and that it poses a direct threat to the safety and stability of the Dominican Republic. The statement predicted the situation could deteriorate even further if a peacekeeping force is not implemented urgently to restore order. Caribbean leaders have called for an emergency meeting in Jamaica on what they called Haiti's dire situation. Here's a story about the war in Ukraine. White flag comment draws rebuke. Pope's spokesman denies remark was a call for surrender. Ukrainian and allied officials Sunday criticized Pope Francis for saying that Kiev should have the courage to negotiate an end to the war with Russia, a statement many interpreted as a call for Ukraine to surrender. The foreign ministers of Ukraine and Poland, a vocal ally of Kiev, condemned the Pope's remarks, and a leader of one of Ukraine's Christian churches on Sunday said that only the country's determined resistance to Moscow's full-scale invasion launched by Russian President Vladimir Putin on February 24, 2022, had prevented a mass slaughter of civilians. In an interview recorded last month with Swiss broadcast RSI and partially released on Saturday, Francis used the phrase, "the courage of the white flag," as he argued that Ukraine, facing a possible defeat, should be open to peace talks brokered by international powers. "Our flag is blue and yellow. We live, die, and win under it. We will not raise other flags," Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba posted on Sunday on X, formerly known as Twitter. Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sabowski tweeted, "How about for balance, encouraging Putin to have the courage to withdraw his army from Ukraine? Peace would immediately ensue without the need for negotiations." In his tweet, Kuleba urged the Holy See to not repeat historical mistakes, as he alleged that the Vatican didn't do enough to resist Nazi Germany. Yet he also invited Francis to Ukraine, saying the Pope's visit would show support for more than 1 million Ukrainian Roman Catholics and more than 5 million Greek Catholics, all Christians and all Ukrainians. The head of Ukraine's Greek Catholic Church, Archbishop Svyatoslav Shevka, said Sunday that surrender isn't on the minds of Ukrainians. "Ukraine is exhausted, but it stands and it will endure. Believe me, it never crosses anyone's mind to surrender. Even where there is fighting today, listen to our people in Kherson, Svazia, Odessa, Kharkiv, Sunny," Shvak said while meeting with Ukrainians in New York City. He mentioned that reasons that have been under heavy Russian artillery and drone attacks. Shevchuk also spoke to the brutality of Moscow's invasion, referencing the town near Kiev where Russian occupation left hundreds of civilians dead in the streets and in mass graves. He argued that the gruesome scenes seen in Bucha would have just been an introduction if not for Ukrainians' fierce resistance as Russian troops marched on the capital in February 2022. Vatican spokesman Mario Bruni on Saturday clarified that the Pope supported a stop to the hostilities and a truce achieved with the courage of negotiations, rather than an outright Ukrainian surrender. Bruni said that the journalist interviewing Francis used the term white flag in the question that prompted the controversial remarks. "I think that the strongest one is one who looks at the situation, thinks about the people, and has the courage of the white flag and negotiates," Francis said. Getting back to a little local news here, Iowa Western gets $500,000 grant. Iowa Western Community College will receive a $500,000 grant from the Federal Aviation Administration to help purchase new tools and equipment for its aviation maintenance technology program. The Council Bluffs Community College has one of the oldest aviation maintenance technician programs in the country, Aviation Department Chair Dylan Driscoll said. We've been around a long time, so a lot of our tooling is older. A lot of our aircraft are older. And so a lot of it's going to be retooling, basically getting all new top-of-the-line tools and things like that. Driscoll said that the program is looking into adding an avionics course, which would focus solely on aircraft electronics like communication and navigation systems. Iowa Western is one of 32 schools nationwide to receive part of the $13.5 million in grants from the FAA Aviation Maintenance Technical Workforce Development Program, which was made available by the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018. Aviation training programs offer Iowans job security and opportunities for a career. By investing in Iowans' future and our community colleges, these grants will help meet the national demand for skilled aviation workers. The average age of aviation mechanics is around 60-plus years old, Driscoll said. Skilled pilots are also getting older, and there aren't enough bodies in the pipeline to maintain the workforce. With just retirement, and then when COVID hit, it really came to a head, Driscoll said. And not only mechanics, but you have pilots, flight instructors, and the same thing that happened with mechanics happened with pilots. As older pilots and mechanics retire, everybody kind of moves up a rung, leaving companies scrambling to fill entry-level positions, Driscoll said. There's just not enough out there, so wages have gone crazy. We've got mechanics straight out of school making $38 an hour, so it's really lucrative for them. Driscoll said that when he graduated from the Iowa Western Aviation Maintenance Program, he had to travel around the country to visit potential employees, but now they all come to us. They do interviews and hire people right at our facility, Driscoll said. We're at the Council Bluffs Airport. They fly in, come in, interview, and the students don't even have to go anywhere. Because the need for aviation mechanics is so great, graduates can also play employees off one another to get higher wages or better benefits, Driscoll said. The competition from the employers has gotten so high they can't find people, he said. According to the FAA, approximately 20,000 fewer people are working in aircraft maintenance than before the pandemic. The FAA grant program will enable Iowa Western to expand its aviation maintenance program and provide valuable education in the highly skilled career field. Iowa Western Vice President of Academic Affairs Jenny Kruger said in a news release, our focus will be on training the next generation of aviation maintenance professionals and filling the much-needed workforce pool. Iowa Western also recently hired a third aviation instructor, which could help boost enrollment in the program. The FAA requires that we maintain a 25-to-1 student-to-instructor ratio, so with just myself and the second-year instructor, we're limited to 50 students. But with the addition of the third staff member now, technically we could have up to 75, Driscoll said. The FAA grant will also help Iowa Western promote the aviation mechanics program to not only high school students, but also to adults looking to change careers and military veterans. That's something we've been working on, is to increase our profile to veterans, Driscoll said. It's a logical choice to them because you can be in the Air Force for 30 years, you retire, you have to get the same certification as a kid who just got out of high school, so we're trying to make it easier for them to do that. Recreational pilots who own their own airplanes are also required to earn an Aviation Maintenance Technology Certificate, or Associate of Applied Science degree. I get retired people who are pilots, and they just want to be able to work on their own aircraft. So anywhere from 17 to 70 years old, we have students come through, so that's all age brackets, Driscoll said. And like I said, with the demand for mechanics right now, it's a logical choice for adults who want to change careers too. For more information about the Iowa Western Aviation Maintenance Technology Program, visit iwcc.edu. Board okays ordinance about wind solar farms. After months of debate and listening to public input, the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors recently approved new regulations for wind and solar energy projects. We have, I think, done really our due diligence on this, on the documents that are all presented to you, and it meets all of the public feedback that we've heard, along with all of the board considerations that we put into this, Planning and Development Director Matt Wyatt said at the February 27th board meeting. The discussion about wind energy ordinance has generated a lot of input from the community for and against in the 9 months since the county first looked into amending it. There was definitely passions on both sides of the issue here, but what we heard a lot more from residents who just really objected to having them put so close to their property lines or to their homes, Wyatt told the Nonpareil in the interview. While devising the new ordinance, Wyatt said it was important to keep in mind the county's future growth opportunities. It's our population that is really the factor in whether or not more windmills are placed in Pottawatomie County, Wyatt told supervisors. We're growing, so if we're set to grow more, and we sure don't want to hamper any of our small towns from their growth patterns, nor our Council Bluffs Airport's growth. While protecting Pottawatomie County's smaller communities' ability to grow, however, the new ordinance may have also knocked some wind from the sales of future wind energy projects. With this ordinance, how it's worded is restrictive for our project, Matt Spakanakia, development manager for electrical generation company RWE, told the Nonpareil. This ordinance brings challenges, but I believe that we can move forward with the project in development. RWE's wind turbines would generate $25 million for landowners and bring the county and its smaller communities $54 million in new tax revenue over 30 years. We have landowners, many of them signed on to this project for years now, and continued to get landowners interested, and it seems like landowners are eager for a project here. The new ordinance for commercial use wind energy systems states that wind turbines must be set back a minimum of 3 miles from communities, parks, and recreation areas, and the Council Bluffs Municipal Airport. We have heard from the airport authority. We have heard from companies out there at the airport that do the training, and it is a big training hub for pilots and future pilots, and we have to do what we can to make sure that we protect that availability, Wyatt told the Nonpareil. We all see the shortage of pilots that's out there, so having that good training hub, I mean, it brings a big benefit to our area. Turbines must also be at least 1,500 feet from lot lines or public right-of-ways, and a half a mile from the closest non-participating homes, unless the property owner agrees to waive the setback distance. Even then, the turbine still cannot be located closer than 1/10 its total height from a dwelling. RWE currently has contracts with about 120 landowners that covers 20,000 acres and would generate 200 megawatts. As of right now, it's a lower amount of buildable area that we envisioned, but through getting more and more landowners signed up onto the project, which has been happening more recently, which is good to see, it's going to open up buildable acres for us. And more landowners signing onto the project will reduce those setbacks, which will help us with buildable acres. Wind turbines cannot be taller than 412 feet. Which is the height of the wind turbines that make up MidAmerican Energy's wind farm east of Walnut. The board wanted to look at what the Walnut wind farm was currently at, so that was the height we went for, Wyatt said. While most of the attention has been on wind turbines, the ordinance does include new regulations for solar energy systems as well. I think you do see on the solar impacts that they're a lot less visually impactful, Wyatt said. You might have a solar array farm on a 40-acre chunk versus spread out over 12,000 acres. For commercial projects, solar panels must be lower than 2 feet off the ground and no higher than 20 feet. Additionally, the solar panels cannot be within 300 feet from a non-participating structure. There is no setback for participating property owners. If a solar energy system is solely for personal use, ground-mounted solar panels cannot be higher than 15 feet, while the panels affixed to a structure like the roof of a house or barn cannot extend higher than the height allowed by the district's zoning regulations. Setbacks for ground-mounted solar panels are 10 feet from another building or structure of the same lot. Solar panels are not allowed in the front yard setback unless they are at least 50 feet back away from the edge of the county road right-of-way or 80 feet from the edge of a state or federal right-of-way. Solar is more contained in delivering energy than wind systems, Wyatt said. So I do think you see a lot more support for the solar just for those factors than what you see for wind. Here's an opinion from the Nonpareil. Teacher pay raise needs Senate okays. House bill would raise minimum pay to $50,000 over the next 2 years. The Iowa House has been generating a lot of proposals in recent days. Some have us wondering about lawmakers' priorities, but House File 2630 passed the chamber with a near unanimous support, and we hope Iowa lawmakers in the Iowa Senate find the proposal worthy of a similar vote to approval. The bill would raise the state's minimum teacher salary to $50,000 over the next 2 years and require a minimum $15 minimum wage for any non-salaried school staff. Representative Bill Gustaf, a Republican from Des Moines, called the legislation the largest single boost to teacher pay in history of the state. The House proposal isn't the only one that would boost Iowa's teachers' paychecks, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' controversial overhaul of the state's area education agencies included a provision to increase starting teacher salaries to $50,000 and increase teacher pay within 12 years, with 12 years' experience to $62,000. Senate Republicans are considering an amended version of Reynolds' AEA bill that would set the minimum teacher salary at $46,251. That's slightly less than the minimum salary paid by the Council Bluffs Community School District, which competes for teacher talent within the larger Omaha metropolitan area. The current mandatory minimum salary for Iowa teachers is $33,500. The National Education Association says that the average salary for starting teachers in Iowa is $39,208, which ranks 35th among the 50 states. Moving the starting salary to $50,000 in today's dollars would move Iowa to 6th in the nation. Funding for the raises would come from the state's coffers through the supplemental aid to schools, not from local property taxes. If we learn nothing from COVID-19, which admittedly might well be the case, we should have learned the importance of classroom teachers. We are blessed in this community with excellent educators who highlight the importance of treating teachers as professions. We shouldn't allow classrooms to be led by untrained amateurs, but if we want to continue having talented professionals in those roles, they deserve fair compensation. House File 2630 would go a long way toward this end, and we think it merits passage. With that said, we recognize that many residents of our community would look at $50,000 a year salary or even $15 an hour wage and wonder why they aren't enjoying similar prosperity. Teachers certainly deserve fair pay, but so do other workers in our economy who are often left behind. Iowa's minimum wage remains at the federal rate of $7.25. School employees under HF 2630 would stand to make more than double that, albeit still short of what MIT would consider a living wage for single working adults. We believe that Iowa House, in a bipartisan fashion, is doing for teachers should be extended to the rest of the state's workforce through an increase to the minimum wage. Our neighbors in Nebraska, hardly a bastion of progressive politics, managed to raise theirs to $12. It will hit $15 by 2026, So far, the sky hasn't fallen. Perhaps giving our state's teachers the raise they rightfully deserve can serve as a first step. You are listening to the Council Plus Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, John McPartland. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. Okay, now we have a couple sports stories for you. Number three, Iowa outlasts Nebraska in overtime for third straight Big Ten title. Caitlin Clark overcame a cold start to score 30 of her 34 points after halftime and helped third-ranked Iowa rally past Nebraska 94-89 in overtime to win a third straight Big Ten tournament on Sunday. "It never gets old cutting the net," Clark said, after black and gold confetti covered the court at Target Center to the delight of another sellout crowd packed with Hawkeye fans. "I feel like we're pretty good at that." Hannah Stokey had 25 points and 9 rebounds for Iowa, which is 29-4, but they which trailed by 13 points late in the first half, while their superstar Clark missed all 9 of her 3-point attempts. "You can maybe keep Caitlin down for a half, but you're not keeping her down for a whole game," Hawkeyes coach Lisa Bluder said. The all-time NCAA leading scorer finished 5 of 17 from deep, had 12 assists, and hit the dagger three-pointer with 51 seconds left in overtime for an 89-87 lead, just 16 seconds after Logan Nisley's three-pointer put the Cornhuskers in front. "I knew some shots were going to go in," Clark said. "That's just how it works." Alexis Markowski had 23 points and 13 rebounds to lead Nebraska, which is 22-11, in a valiant performance that fell short of a second victory over Iowa this season. The Huskers beat the Hawkeyes 82-79 on February 11th. "Nobody else did, but we expected to win," said Nebraska coach Amy Williams, who had tears streaming down her face at the postgame interview podium. Okay, now we have a couple letters to ask Amy. Husband's new friend becomes a menace. "My husband and I are in our mid-70s. Steve is 20 years younger. He befriended my husband and started stopping by our house, offering help with technical problems. Steve would chat with me and then head to the man cave to watch sports on TV, etc. with my husband. He seemed nice. A couple months ago, Steve grabbed my face with both hands and kissed me full on the mouth. This was not a friendly peck on the cheek. He overpowered me. I was so shocked that I just stepped back and was silent. After that, whenever Steve was expected at the house, I would hide out in my backyard studio. One day, he arrived earlier than expected, and when I opened my studio door, he was standing in the doorway. I pushed past him and left. I finally decided to tell my husband what was going on. To my surprise, he didn't seem to think this was a big deal. He refused to stop this guy's visits to our house. I had threatened to actually leave him before he agreed not to have Steve in our house. My husband likes the help of Steve, gives him with the computers, etc. Yesterday, he asked me to reconsider having him over. He says he's a nice guy. I feel terribly disrespected and hurt and don't know how to get over this." "Dear betrayed, Steve sexually assaulted you. Your response to the assault is a common reaction. You were shocked and tried to get through the moment. After that, you avoided this person because you didn't feel safe. This was a smart move, not because you are not safe around him. I find your description of this guy's presence in your lives disturbing. The first point I want to make is that if he did this to you, I would think it's possible that he would commit a crime against your husband, too. Steve should not have any access to your computer, accounts, or personal information on your family or at home. In terms of your husband's reaction, I can't imagine how heartbroken you must feel that he isn't more supportive of you. When Steve steals your husband's identity, he might feel differently about this friendship. I think you have some decisions to make, including the idea of pursuing the matter through the criminal justice system. In addition to the assault, Steve showed up at the backyard studio entrance on your property at an unexpected time. A restraining order would legally keep him off your property. Then you wouldn't have to worry about your husband's weird and worrisome efforts to bring him back. If you're unsure about your options, a counselor could help you sort all things out. Here's an article on pandas, where to see the pandas. China, for the first time in more than two decades, is sending pandas to the United States, but it will still be months before the San Diego Zoo gets them. For now, the only U.S. zoo left with any is in Atlanta, but globally there are many places to check out the cuddly black and white bundles of fur as they munch on bamboo, climb trees, and lounge on their backs. The bear is native to China, where it is considered a national treasure. Here are some of the places where the pandas can be seen, including possibly in the wild in China. Atlanta. Zoo Atlanta has four pandas, including the first twins born in the United States in more than a quarter century. Giant pandas typically care for only one cub when twins are born in the wild, which usually just leads to one twin surviving. Ya Loon and X Loon and their parents, Loon Loon and Yang Yang, could be heading back to China in late 2024, unless the loan agreement is extended. Mexico City. The only other place in the Americas where people can see pandas is in Mexico City at the Chapultepec Zoo. Xin Xin is the last panda in Latin America and not on loan from China. That's because she's the only remaining bear descending from the giant pandas China gifted to foreign countries during the 70s and 80s. The second-generation Mexican-born panda traces her lineage to Pepe and Ying Ying, who arrived at the zoo in 1975. Here's a story about should your phone get wet. It says, when the phone gets wet, keep the rice in the cupboard. Here are other ways to fix it. You're walking next to a swimming pool when you slipped and dropped your phone into the water, or it slipped out of your hand when you were next to the filled bathtub or toilet. However your smartphone got wet, you now need to dry it. But what do? There's a lot of advice on the internet, some of it conflicting. Apple inserted itself into the debate recently when it put out an advisory warning that included a warning against using rice. Here are some things to keep in mind next time your phone has an unintended encounter with liquid. Dry off the exterior with a towel or clean cloth, even your shirt sleeve, anything that's absorbent. Take out the SIM card and holder. If possible, remove the back housing and battery to wipe them dry. Also, if possible, turn the phone off. iPhones can't be disassembled. So Apple recommends tapping it gently against your hand with the connector ports facing down so liquid can flow out. Samsung, which is the biggest maker of Android phones, recommends using a cotton bud to get moisture out of the earphone jack and charging port. In contrast, Apple says cotton buds shouldn't be inserted into iPhone openings. If it's not water but another liquid, a drink, seawater, or chlorinated pool water, Samsung advises soaking the phone in clean water for a few minutes, then rinsing it to get rid of any impurity or salinity that could speed up corrosion of the circuitry inside. Both companies say it is best to leave the phone out in a well-ventilated area, perhaps with a fan to dry it out. Google says leave the device to dry at room temperature. Here's what you shouldn't do. Don't use a hairdryer or compressed air on your phone. Don't put it in a freezer. This might stop your device from short-circuiting, but the problem will be back once you try to thaw it out. And while this might seem obvious, don't put your device in a tumble dryer or on top of a radiator. Don't power it up or try to charge it with a cable, although wireless charging is okay if your phone has it and you really need to turn it on in emergency. So what about using rice to dry your device? You may have heard that putting a phone in a bowl of rice will help draw out the moisture. It's been a tip that's been out there for years. Apple, however, says that's a no-no. The company warned against it in an advisory published in early January. It drew little attention at the time, but then people noticed the line that said, "Don't put your iPhone in a bag of rice. Doing so could allow small particles of rice to damage your iPhone." Is there anything I can use besides rice? The best option is silica gel, a drying agent that it can absorb lots of moisture. Silica gel beads are typically found in packets that are included with products like beef jerky, seaweed sheets, or sneakers to keep them dry. You can also buy them in bulk online. This works best if you put them in an airtight box with your phone. When do I know if it's dry? It's hard to tell, but it's best to wait as long as possible, at least a few days. Samsung advises bringing your device into a service center for inspection, even after it's been air dried. Aren't phones waterproof nowadays? Most phones nowadays are designed to be water resistant, which means they can resist water entering critical areas for a certain amount of time. But beware, this isn't the same as waterproof. Apple says the iPhone 7 and newer models are splash and water resistant. iPhone XS devices and up have the IP68 rating, which means they can be submerged for as long as 30 minutes and, depending on the model, as deep as 20 feet. These models also pop up warning if there's liquid detected in key ports and warns against charging. Samsung says most of its Android phones feature the same rating, though the maximum depth is about 16 feet. Google's newer Pixel phones carry the same water-resistant ratings, but Google warns that they aren't waterproof and the water resistance will diminish over time because of normal wear and tear, device repair, and disassembly or damage. Here's some things to watch on Monday, March 11th. Netflix is premiering a new show called Young Royals. This Swedish teen romantic drama series returns for its third and final season. It stars Edvin Ryding as a fictional Prince William who arrives at the prestigious boarding school, Hillerska, and gets an opportunity to explore his true self and find out what kind of life he really wants. He starts dreaming of a future far away from his royal obligations, but when he unexpectedly becomes next in line for the throne, he must make a choice, love or duty. The first 5 episodes dropped today. The series finale will be available March 18th. We got some college basketball on ESPN, ESPN2, and ESPNU. Tonight's conference tournament action includes the Horizon League semifinals on ESPNU and ESPN2, the Sun Belt Final, ESPN2, the SoCon Final, ESPN, and the West Coast Conference Semifinals, ESPN and ESPN2. CBS has on tonight at 7 o'clock is The Neighborhood. Calvin, Cedric the Entertainer, is adjusting to getting older and new stages of parenting in the new episode, Welcome to Grandfatherhood. On CW at 7, we have Ride. The McMurrays prepare to host a family wedding at the ranch in the new episode, Speak Now or Forever Hold Your Peace. On NBC at 7, we have The Voice. It's the Blind Auditions Part 5. The coaches continue their search for the best undiscovered voice in America. Now on PBS, we have Antiques Roadshow at 7 o'clock. They head to Baton Rouge, Louisiana for captivating finds, including a tablecloth signed by Muhammad Ali, a Panerai Randomer watch, and a letter by abolitionist Frederick Douglass. One is worth up to $100,000. TLC has 90 Day Fiancé, The Single Life. Excuse me, the 90 Day Fiancé, The Single Life,
It's at 7 o'clock on TLC. And Natalie asks a question. Natalie asks Mike about their potential future. Giannis invites Chantel on a mystery date before she leaves Greece. And Debbie lashes out at Julian for meddling in her love life and says goodbye to Ruben. HGTV at 9 o'clock says a new series, Lakefront Empire. In the Midwest coast, a big boat dock is a must for agent Peggy Albers' luxury couple. However, will her new client stick with her when Peggy's criminal past comes out? Agent Justin Farrell's friends are looking for a weekend cabin getaway. He's happy with a fixer, but she wants move-in ready. Now, NBC at 9 has Deal or No Deal Island. With the largest prize in Deal or No Deal history on the line, the 11 remaining players compete at dizzying heights. With tensions high, a fight breaks out as one player makes a game-altering decision. Now we have some movies that are on today. On the Hallmark Channel at 5 p.m., we have Falling for Vermont, starring Julia Gonzalez and Benjamin Ives. Paramount at 7 p.m., we have The Gladiator, starring Russell Crowe and Joaquin Phoenix. Hallmark at 7 p.m., we have Moonlight in Vermont, 2017 romance comedy, starring Lacey Shepard and Carlos Marx. Blues Brothers is on at 9:30 p.m. on Pop, starring John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. We have a story here that says, as Ramadan starts, pier equipment heads to Gaza. First ship is still in waiting in Cyprus. A U.S. Army vessel carrying equipment to build a temporary pier in Gaza was heading to the Mediterranean on Sunday, after U.S. President Joe Biden announced plans to increase aid deliveries by sea to the besieged enclave where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are going hungry. The new push for aid came as the Muslim holy month of Ramadan was set to begin Monday in much of the world after officials in Saudi Arabia saw the crescent moon. Hopes for a new ceasefire by Ramadan faded days ago, with negotiations apparently stalled. The opening of the sea corridor, along with airdrops by the U.S., Jordan, and others, is reflecting growing alarm over Gaza's deadly humanitarian crisis and a new willingness to bypass Israel's control over land shipments. But aid officials say that air and sea deliveries can't make up for a shortage of land routes. Aid trucks entering Gaza daily are far below the 500 entering before the war. A ship belonging to Spanish aid group Open Arms and carrying 200 tons of food aid was expected to make a pilot voyage to Gaza from nearby Cyprus as soon as possible, but not Sunday, said Linda Roth, a spokesperson for partner organization World Central Kitchen. There was no explanation after Cyprus president had said it would leave then. Israel says it welcomes the sea deliveries and would inspect Gaza-bound cargo before it leaves Cyprus. Israel Defense Minister Yoav Gallant reviewed preparatory work off Gaza's coast on Sunday. Just a few news briefs. They have a record-setting storm pound South Carolina. A record-setting rainstorm flooded parts of Charleston, South Carolina, on Saturday, requiring emergent responders to help some people get out of the high water. The National Weather Service in Charleston reported that 3.63 inches of rain doused downtown Charleston on Saturday, shattering the one-day record of 1.43 inches from 1948. The 1.95 inches of rainfall recorded at Charleston International Airport broke a record of 1.13 inches set in 1998. The pounding rain in the coastal city came coupled with a morning high tide. Now we have just a few entertainment briefs. Paltrow had difficult relation with stepkids. Gwyneth Paltrow used to have a difficult relationship with her stepchildren. The 51-year-old actress became a stepmother to Brody, 17, and 20-year-old Isabella when she married TV producer Brad Falchuk in 2018. She says that even though she now thinks of them as her own, she had to learn a lot in the early days. Speaking at the Visionary Women's International Women's Day Summit, she said, "The path to here was really rough. It's almost like you have to embody the spirit of the sun and just give and not expect anything back. I just learned to try to just keep shining like the sun and never keeping score." The Goop founder was joined by political activist Nicole Avant, who said that when she became a stepmother herself, she had to constantly find her own identity. Avant said, "I kept feeling that my identity was being challenged every single day, and I was trying to be their mom, but all of a sudden I was the girlfriend that they loved and they wanted their father to marry." And we got Pamela Anderson, "I want to challenge beauty." Pamela Anderson wants to challenge beauty with her look. The 56-year-old actress recently adopted a makeup-free approach, explaining that she wants to flip the script on the beauty industry. The former Baywatch star told CR Fashion Book, "When I was at Paris Fashion Week, people asked me about that a lot, and I think, well, I was doing it for me. Can I walk out the door like this? Like, I'm fine the way I am, and I just didn't want to get into the whole glam thing and play the game." Anderson's agents and her kids were initially hesitant about her makeup-free appearance, but the actress has actually doubled down on the idea in recent months. Anderson shared, "My agents and even my kids were like, 'Mom, you can't. You need the glam team.' And I said, 'The fact that you guys are saying that to me makes me want to do it more. I'm going to do a fresh face, no makeup, not pretend no makeup.' And it just felt free. No one looked at me and went, 'Ah.'" That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council of Us Nonpareil. I'm your reader, John McPartland. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Services for the Blind. Have a good day.